Thanks for downloading a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned for your 3CR podcast.
Welcome to Freedom of Species. We're the show that brings animal advocacy to the airwaves of 3CR Community Radio. Before us, you heard Sally with Out of the Pan featuring Chloe Petz regarding their Melbourne International comedy show, Big Natural. And Sally finished off with a song, I'll Get by Caitlin Barnett, or Harnett, sorry, and the Pony Boys. And yeah, you can catch Sally's show every Sunday, 12 to 1 here on 3CR. So I am Nick, and I am joined on the show by Betty. Do you want to talk a little bit about what the plan is for today, Betty?
Yeah, so today we're planning to just have a bit of a casual, fairly off-the-cuff conversation about why the struggle against animal agriculture is essential within the climate movement. And I know this is something you've talked about a little bit in the past, Nick.
Yeah, not for quite a few years, though. So, yeah, and I feel like that also kind of fits with this issue, I think, being off the radar for quite a few years. And I guess, like, I kind of analyze that, but I feel like I'm a part of that as well. Just to give one example of that, I did see an article, How to Make People Want to Read About Climate Change. And this came out in November 4, 2025. And that's been sitting unopened on my phone since then. And so I was like, I found it difficult to read an article about wanting to read about climate change. And so, yeah, I feel like there's been kind of a bit of a move away. Like, again, I've done a lot of shows, like particularly sort of 2019, early 2020, about climate change. But since then, I feel like, I don't know, it was something of like, it was too much. Like, there was so much momentum for the climate movement, you know, in 2019 and early 2020. And then the COVID pandemic hit, and it was hard to maybe keep focus on that climate change pandemic when there was the COVID, the COVID pandemic going on. And then I feel like since then, I don't know, people have just moved on to other issues. I teach at university, and again, around 2019, 2020, or even a few years before that, like, I'd talk on a different social movement, and all the questions were about climate, and it was such a big focus, and the last few years, not so much as well.
Interesting.
Also, the last, like, election in Australia wasn't such a big issue. I think the election before, like, Greens won quite a lot of votes because they clearly had better climate policies than the two major parties. And yeah, like the last election, it wasn't a huge focus from the Greens necessarily. And yeah, it wasn't a huge like topic that was debated very much in the election generally. So yeah, it's just a different context we're talking about it. Cause I felt at like, again, several years ago, pre-COVID, it was like, oh, everyone's really concerned about climate change. The problem is that people are like not bringing animal agriculture into that. And now we're kind of at the point where even climate change itself doesn't seem to be a huge issue that's discussed at the moment.
Yeah, I remember they had those big school strikes for climate that was happening in 2019. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I guess the pandemic kind of cut the legs off a lot of activism that was happening right before that. And these days I feel like people are maybe more focused on geopolitical stuff, like, you know, obviously what's happening in Palestine and now Iran, which is, of course, related with climate change because everything's related with climate change.
Yeah.
But I guess we see now our reliance on oil and gas is sort of becoming like very obvious how much of a problem that is to everyone. We see like the fuel prices going right up and everything, and that's all because of this Strait of Hormuz around Iran and how much of the world's oil has to pass through there.
Yeah.
And now because, you know, Trump has attacked Iran, like all these prices have gone up. But I guess I don't see people talking about it in such a climate change way. It's more like cost of living and, I guess people just don't like wars generally.
Yeah.
So I'm, you know, those issues are very important, but I think we need to consider them in the context of climate change too.
Absolutely. I remember, like, I'm older than you are, but I've been following this stuff for a long time, and I remember maybe, I'm not sure exactly when this documentary came out, but maybe about 2005, called The End of Suburbia, and it was all about how we're running out of oil and we can't be dependent on cars and all this kind of stuff. And I was thinking, yeah, it's like a good point, but probably until it actually starts impacting people of like they go to the fuel station and they're like fuel is literally out, it's sort of hard. Like if you're just putting in and whenever you rock up to a fuel station, there's plenty of fuel, then it's hard to kind of go, oh, but not even philosophically, but like globally, we're kind of using too much and all these things. It's like when it actually affects people on a day-to-day basis is kind of when it hits in. Of course, that's too late, but as you say, that's happening now, but it's not like, this is because of climate change. This is what Trump is doing in Iran. Yeah.
Yeah. But before we get too much deeper into the conversation, I thought maybe we should just give an overview of what is climate change, actually.
And maybe actually before you do that, I did want to just briefly mention, if anyone wants to text in, and this could be, you know, anyone, like could be animal advocates talking about advocating for this issue. It could be people who are more in the climate movement generally and haven't thought about as much about animals, but how you think about animal agriculture and how it relates. But either way, we welcome any text in. So I'll give the number 0488. 809-855. I'll give it one more time. Get your pen, your paper, your phone. 0488-809-855. And save that number away and text in to all of the 3CR shows you listen to.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. It would be great to have some discussion as well. Mm-hmm. So climate change generally refers to the rapid warming of the planet. We're talking rapid in a relative sense because it usually happens over the span of tens of thousands of years, but more recently it's been happening over the span of decades. And this is resulting in changes in global weather patterns because of an increase in greenhouse gases in the atmosphere due to human industrial activity. The three main greenhouse gases are carbon dioxide, methane, and nitrous oxide. And they all have different warming potentials and different amounts of time that they stay in the atmosphere. And the main reason these greenhouse gases have increased in the atmosphere, particularly since the second half of the 20th century, is due to the burning of fossil fuels and increased agricultural emissions due to a rise in industrialized animal agriculture. And going hand in hand, particularly with the animal agriculture piece of that, is we also have a huge loss of forests, which store a lot of carbon. And the biggest reason for deforestation historically and in present day has been due to increasing land for animal agriculture. Mm-hmm. So deforestation is a requirement for that. And when we're grazing animals, there can't be a wild forest there. Yeah, so that's basically what climate change is. So there's two main parts to this, and there are a lot of like little things causing climate change as well, but it's mostly due to the burning of fossil fuels and this emissions due to animal agriculture. And methane and nitrous oxide tend to come more from farmed animals, especially ruminants like cows, sheep, and goats, whereas the CO2 tends to come more from the burning of fossil fuels.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's definitely important to have a movement against the oil and gas industries, but it shouldn't be all the climate movement focuses on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I guess, like, we were talking about this off-air a little bit, but, yeah, I guess why activists like the two of us focus a lot on animal agriculture is because while more needs to be done about fossil fuels, that is already the central focus of the climate movement, whereas animal agriculture, yeah, is also a big part of the puzzle but only has, like, a very, very tiny focus in the climate movement overall.
Yeah. And within other movements too, I mean, yeah, me and Nick were just chatting about this. One of the reasons why animal rights has been the center of my activism for many years is because it's not a standard issue within leftist spaces, within feminist spaces, within climate justice spaces. I can be sitting down at a table with anarchist, climate activist, feminist, and somehow I'm the only vegan. Mm-hmm. And as long as that's the case, I have to keep being an animal rights activist. You know, it is what it is.
Yeah. And actually, it was interesting actually that, a colleague of mine, Corey Wren, who does kind of similar work in the vegan sociology space, like she's done media analysis. And actually, like, The Guardian was the most negative towards veganism in terms of the coverage.
Really?
And, like, Fox News was actually fairly positive. So it's kind of weird because I definitely see things the other way of, like, obviously I see, veganism very consistent with, like, left-wing or progressive politics because it's more about, you know, compassion and challenging hierarchies and then these kind of things. Whereas, like, to me, animal agriculture seems very consistent with right-wing politics because right makes right, dominant. Nation, these kind of things, which are very
and land consistent. Occupation.
Yeah, exactly. Like consistent with like sexism, racism, etc., colonialism, and those kind of things. And so, it is weird when it goes the other way.
Yeah. So, I know we've got a few examples of things we want to talk about related to this issue. So, where should we start?
Well, maybe while we're kind of talking, and we've already got into the animal agriculture as well, but I guess while we're talking about climate in general, just a point I had, which, doesn't relate to animal agriculture, but does relate to climate, and I will bring it back to animals as well. But, we also mentioned the invasion of Iran as well. And so because of all that and the oil issues, there's been free public transport in Melbourne just for the month.
Yeah.
Have you been making the most of that at all? Or
not really.
No, I haven't. I generally walk just about everywhere. So I haven't personally, I used it much at all, I think once. I do think it is a really positive policy change that I would love to see it continued indefinitely. And I know Green Left Radio here on 3CR has done quite a bit of coverage on this in terms of talking about the way in which the cost of like the ticket inspectors, the cost of the Mikey machines and maintaining them and all this kind of stuff, like it wouldn't be that much more to make it free because you cut back on all these other costs, which you don't necessarily need. Well, you don't need it all if it's free. So it wouldn't be much more expensive because of those things, or that would make it at least like not as much as it would seem on the surface. But even beyond that, like there's obviously social benefits in terms of low income people being able to get around for free, even like less people being caught up in the legal system, like people who are homeless or in poverty in general and can't afford it and then get tickets and then get unpaid fines and get caught up in the legal system, issues in terms of like reduced health issues due to better air quality within the city. I feel like this overall cost benefit analysis, I feel like it would be net positive. Even economically, possibly, again, I haven't done a full analysis of that, but at least potentially either like a net positive economically or even at least, again, not as much of a cost as it would seem up front because of all those kind of side benefits. But also, again, bringing in the animals as well, I also think it's a positive policy for animals. Obviously, you know, your buses and trams, etc., can hit animals, but there'd definitely be like a lot less vehicles in the road and therefore less injuries and deaths to animals as well. So I feel like it's such a win-win-win all-around policy.
Yeah. Something else I've been thinking about, because we were talking about people will stop using as much oil and gas when it's too expensive for them to do so. Mm-hmm. And another thing I think about is that animal products are kind of artificially affordable because they're very expensive to produce in terms of the resources that they take.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder if that cost was kind of reflected honestly in what we saw on the shelves, maybe people would be more inclined to eat plant-based, right?
Yeah, like McDonald's, for example. Like the food is very cheap, but it's like in terms of the sort of the footprint of that, like ecologically, like it's not actually cheap, but as you say, it's artificially cheap due to subsidies to animal agriculture and those kind of issues. Yeah.
So I guess with the climate movement, we do want it to be, and it has to be an inclusive movement that, it includes a lot of people and it has to be a coalition. So I'm not sure if I would go so far as to say, like, you must be vegan before you can be a climate activist.
Mm-hmm.
Because that sounds a little too exclusive. But I think that this issue sort of needs to not be disputed within the climate movement, that it's a huge contributor to climate change and environmental destruction.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. It's not so much saying like the climate movement should be limited to vegans, but more there should be a more widespread acknowledgement that animal agriculture is an important piece of the puzzle when it comes to climate change. And then we can talk about how do we deal with that. And that obviously can include individual change like veganism. It can include like policy changes and like structural shifts as well. But like we can have that discussion, but it needs to be acknowledged as an issue, legitimate issue first.
Yeah, and we also briefly spoke about this before, but sometimes I think it might be easier for some climate activists to focus on an issue that they're maybe not so implicated in. So mm-hmm. it's very easy to blame capitalism or blame these corporations, but it's maybe harder to look at what you're doing yourself.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, yeah. And maybe that might actually be, I do have a clip from a rally kind of along those lines, but maybe we'll take a song and then we'll play that and then we'll kind of take the discussion from there about that idea of, yeah, what all of our responsibility is, what corporate responsibility, government and individual as well. So we'll start off with we'll play the song Living Thing by Electric Light Orchestra. Anything you want to say about the song, Betty?
Yeah, to be honest, I don't know what this song is actually meant to be about, but in my mind, it's kind of an environmental song.
Okay, yeah.
Whether that's correct or not, that's the way I see it. So, yeah. Living Thing.
You're listening to Freedom of Species on 3CR Community Radio.
Freedom of Species would like to thank Project Fresh Start for their financial support of this program. Project Fresh Start provides free plant-based food to the community, with a focus on providing healthy, fresh plant-based food and education around healthy eating and living in a way that sustains the individual, the community, the animals, and the planet. To find out more about our community lunches and programs, check out projectfreshstart.org.au.
Welcome back to Freedom of Species on 3CR. We've got Betty and Nick here talking about climate change and also the role of animal agriculture in climate change. And just before that song, which was...
Living Thing by Electric Light Orchestra.
Yeah, Betty was talking about the way in which climate movements often have the focus on it's government's fault, it's corporations' fault, and then often... those highlighting animal agriculture and more say, no, it's kind of everyone's fault. It's people, including people in the climate movement's fault in terms of eating animals. And I want to just give an example of that. This is actually a climate speech from Climate Crisis National Day of Action by Melbourne. National Day of Action in Melbourne by Climate Justice Alliance Melbourne. And this was from 2020. February 22, 2020. So yeah, just before the pandemic started, and yeah, probably went about the time there was maybe the most momentum behind the climate movement. This speaker who introduces herself, so I won't kind of mention her details or anything, but yeah, she focuses on this sort of, I would say, like typical messaging within climate movements.
Hi everyone, my name is Naui. I'm part of Uni Students for Climate Justice, and I just want to start by saying that it is amazing to see so many people out here, people that are resilient, people that want right now to demand justice for climate action now. And I want to start by saying that we need to have our finger on the pulse of actually who is responsible for this climate crisis. And the people who are responsible for this climate crisis are people like Origin Australia, who have made their fortunes through fracking the Northern Territory. Shame on them. Yeah. It's companies like BHP that continue to wreak this world with more and more pollution. Shame. Yeah. And also, it's the Australian government that continues to put profits over the environment, profits over the planet, and profit over human need. Shame.
So, yeah, would you agree that that kind of messaging is pretty typical of climate movements?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. And like, I do see some benefits to that messaging, right? Because it's like, we're all coming together. We're not the problem. We're like the solution. and like it's companies and governments that are to blame. So it's kind of, it's very inclusive because unless you're like the CEO of the company or the like prime minister, then it's like, well, this isn't against me. This is like, you know, I'm pointing the finger elsewhere. So I think like that kind of structural messaging is beneficial in terms of creating those mass movements, which again, we did have several years ago, maybe not as strong now as it was in 2019, 2020. Yeah.
Yeah, but I'm sorry, like if you live in the global north, I do think that we are sort of implicated in the problem up to a point. And I guess I get frustrated with this whole there's no ethical consumption under capitalism thing because, well, like that is true. I feel like it gives a lot of people a way to just throw up their hands and be like, well, it doesn't matter what I consume. Because, yeah, overconsumption, like your individual overconsumption, whether you're just like buying too many things, that's also an issue that you're responsible for, and you can't just blame that on corporations.
And I think there is that idea, like that vegan activists coming into those movements, or again, many of us were already part of those movements and are vegan as well. But either way, like bringing up the vegan issue is divisive, which again, I do understand to an extent, because again, that sort of messaging, which we heard in the speech, is like, we're all in this together. We're all pointing the finger elsewhere. Like it's kind of inclusive of anyone. But I do feel like, I guess I question, is it the animal agricultural issue or is it the individual focus? Because we spoke earlier about like policy changes. Like one thing I really like about free public transport, like rather than say like increasing tolls to like reduce car use, for example, is that's going to like disproportionately affect lower income people who are forced to live in the outer suburbs and drive a lot. It's like a more punitive approach, right? Like it's punishing people, it's unequal. Whereas like the free public transport is like a more positive, like you're giving something, you're making it easier for people like to do a better thing rather than punish them for doing something which is not as good but can be the only option for some people depending where you live. So like there are those structural changes, but I also wonder like if there was a group who came into the climate movement and is, you know, doesn't have that focus but is like having signs on the lines of like, you know, ride a bike to work or something like that, like would that be classified as divisive? Because again, that is like individual focus. So I guess my question is, do people claim it's divisive because it's individual focus, or is it divisive because of like speciesism and being invested in eating animals? I don't know, but I just, yeah.
So this is a hard one. And well, maybe this gets a little bit into something else that I was planning to bring up later. Because if someone's got a sign that says ride a bike to work, I mean, I think we both know that like, that's going to be possible for some people and not for others. Like we do live in a very car dependent city. So then.
Yeah. And I think it's also gendered as well. I think like men are like more likely to feel like safe to riding in the city as well, like because of gender norms as well. Like there's all kinds of things, but yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Sorry, I lost my train of thought. But just thinking about, okay, so we might say, so what are the barriers to someone being able to ride a bike to work? And I think we should also ask, what are the barriers to someone being able to eat a plant-based diet or go vegan? And something that I was listening to in preparation for this, someone called Naima Muhammad, who is the organizing director of the North Carolina Environmental Justice Network, and she did a presentation on a panel talking about what it's like to live near a pig farm. And this is in North Carolina. North Carolina is the second biggest pig farming state in the US after Iowa being number one. And basically they have these, you know, people should be vaguely aware of what a pig farm is like. They're intensive operations. So all the pig waste has to go somewhere. It's not like cows being in a field. And that usually goes into these big effluent waste ponds. I think they call them lagoons in the US. So just these big ponds of pig waste, pig excrement. And that is absolutely horrific for the people living near it. And that's a very good example of environmental racism. She referred to a negotiation with the air, like people will crack their door open in the morning and see if the smell is so bad that they can't go outside. You know, we're talking eyes burning, nose burning, sometimes people vomiting from like how horrific this smell is. They can't hang their clothes outside because their clothes will smell like the pig lagoon, and then kids are getting teased at school. These, in the case of the US, these are typically Black and Latino communities living in these areas, and they can't sell their houses and move because their property has no value because of these farms. But then they were also talking about, and this is largely done by this very vertically integrated company called Smithfield Foods, which is, you know, basically pig company, in like based in the US. And other people on the panel were talking about, has there been boycotts against Smithfield Foods? And Naima said, you know, we would like to do that. But the thing is, all the people living in this area, they live in a food desert. The word she used is they're forced to contribute to their own demise. So they actually didn't have a choice to boycott Smithfield Foods, even though they would very much like to, because they know that that is the cause of their problems, right? So I think in those situations, we can see like it might be very difficult for these people to switch to a plant-based diet, even though some of them would very much like to. So that that is a genuine access issue in that case. And there's a lot of cases where it's an access issue. But if you're a person living in Melbourne City, buying all your food from Coles or Woolies, then you do have access to plant-based foods. And so, like, I think that is wrong when people who can do it weaponize the fact that some people can't do it, you know? I find that very frustrating. It's like, okay, the fact that these people living in North Carolina can't go vegan is more of a reason why you should, if you can.
Exactly.
To help them out, right?
Yeah, I've definitely heard that a lot when I've spoken about conferences about veganism or whatever, and then people, oh, veganism's alienating because it's not inclusive of Indigenous people and that kind of thing, like from like white non-Indigenous people. And it's kind of like, and we've obviously, we've had Indigenous vegans on the show, and like Indigenous people are not a monolith, et cetera. And it's like, but either way, it's like, it's kind of like, oh, not everyone can do this, therefore it should be dismissed by anyone. It's like, yes, we need to look at those issues of access, whether it is, as you say, like riding a bike or eating a plant-based diet, whatever it may be, like the barriers for certain groups and trying to address those structural issues. But yeah, I also really like think that's very disingenuous to kind of go, oh, like, oh, here's this group who can't do this, therefore me, who definitely could do this, shouldn't. Like,
Yeah, exactly. And I guess for me, like, you know, I'm a white Australian. I'm going to focus on the way that these issues are being perpetuated by my own community. So, you know, the number of times I've been called a white vegan by a white non-vegan, I'm like, come on, be serious now. Like, the reason why animal agriculture is such a big problem in Australia is because of colonization, right? Animal agriculture got used as a tool of colonization. So that's my primary focus, is to fight against what white Australia has done with animal agriculture.
I feel like also, I think it was Kim Socho's kind of written a lot about like religion and animals and stuff. But anyway, she was saying like she's not making the case that like eating animals is kind of wrong, like throughout all history and all time and all situations. But in her situation, and this applies to me as well, like she can be vegan, therefore it's a better thing to do. And therefore, hopefully other people also consider that from their situation, not trying to bring in other people's situation, but talk about their own situation. Is that a choice they can make? And in which case it's a better choice for animals, better choice for climate, which is our focus today as well.
Yeah. So like if there's an Indigenous person living on country hunting the way that they have been, I'm not actually, like, it's not my job to fight against that. Like, that's got nothing to do with me. That's none of my business. Like, if people within that community want to say something about that, they can do that. But I'm going to be focused on my own community and the ways that we're damaging the environment.
Yeah.
So, absolutely. Like, you know, I don't want to be sort of straw man and say, what about these people over here that aren't us? That maybe sometimes eat animals. Like,
absolutely. Yeah. And I think another kind of objection is kind of around the idea of, sorry, where was I going with that? Oh, that's right. Yeah. Like, so people who are in climate movements who are advocating around animal agriculture, it's kind of like, well, you've got this sort of ulterior motive, right? Which is true. Like I am predominantly vegan for animals, or nearly 100% vegan for animals. That climate is just a side benefit for me, really. But I do acknowledge that it does have a big positive impact on the environment being vegan compared to eating animal products. But like that doesn't necessarily make it invalid. The same as if, for example, people are talking about, you know, we need to stop fossil fuels. And also, just like the pig example you mentioned, like fossil fuel industries are often located in poorer communities, communities of color, et cetera, like communities that are kind of lower down the kind of the hierarchy created by society are kind of live in these undesirable, have or forced to live in these undesirable places, or these things are put near them, et cetera. And so like you're addressing this issue of like, yes, we need to stop the fossil fuels, but we also need to bring in the way in which, you know, certain communities are harmed more than others. Others, like in terms of within a country, but also on a global scale, in terms of things being put in the global south rather than the global north, and all these kind of issues, or the way in which, like a fossil fuel, Adani, for example, like can be negative in terms of climate change, but can also be like particularly harmful to indigenous communities there, etc. Like, I feel like bringing in these like social issues and trying to like reduce harm to individuals or groups, and again, I'd include animals as part of that. That doesn't invalidate the climate argument. That's just like an extra reason to do the thing. If that makes sense. Yeah,
definitely. Yeah. I personally, I guess, as an animal rights activist, I can't actually really separate these things in my mind. It's like all one big problem together that animals is absolutely included in. Yeah.
We might take another song. So the next song is one that I have picked, and this one is, by a band called Petrol Girls. The song is called Treading Water. And yeah, the song is about, it's about climate change, but also kind of about like treading water, like surviving economically as well, like kind of bringing those two together. And it does, I did mention the Greens as well. And like, you know, again, previous elections, maybe more focused on climate change, but then it wasn't kind of where the discussion was. And I do think their focus on public housing and that kind of thing was a good thing. But again, I think we can bring these things together of looking at treading water in terms of climate change, but also treading water in terms of addressing these economic issues.
Freedom of Species thanks Animal Free Science Advocacy for their financial support of this program. Animal Free Science Advocacy works to create a future where no animals are harmed in the name of science. And scientific progress is advanced through animal-free research methods. Become a member today by visiting animalfreesci.org.au. That's animalfreesci.org.au.
Welcome back to Freedom of Species on 3CR Radical Radio. We've got Betty and Nick talking about climate and animals today, and we just heard the song Treading Water by Petrol Girls. Hand over to Betty.
Yeah, so I guess for this last section, I wanted to talk a bit about how easy it is for animal agriculture industries to spread misinformation about their environmental impact. So for this section, I wanted to do a little time travel. So the year is 2013.
I don't have the sound effect, but imagine
that. Oh, yeah, we need a sound effect. The year is 2013. Tony Abbott is the prime minister for at least part of the year. Obama's the president of the US. Trump's never been president yet. What a time to be alive. We're all so young back then. Now, you're a person who's concerned about climate change, but you remain hungry for flesh. And honestly, this could probably describe me in 2013. I was still eating flesh at the time. You come across a TED talk from a man, an ecologist no less, named Alan Savory. He's well-spoken. He seems very wise and trustworthy.
I was going to say, he seems very white.
Well, that too. he's a wealthy white man from Zimbabwe. But, you know, he seems very connected with the land, you know, and he tells you livestock grazing can reverse desertification. And he even shows some before and after pictures, just like an infomercial. How can you argue with that? And you feel comforted by the thought, maybe my hunger for flesh is actually helping the climate. What I'm already doing, what everyone around me is doing, it's okay. I don't need to change. and then you maybe share it on your vegan friend's wall or something. Do you have any memory of this guy or?
I don't know. No, it definitely didn't make it onto my radar. I'm definitely, yeah, I think in 2013 I was probably not quite as off social media as I am now, but I've never been a huge social media person. So, no, this one definitely passed me by.
Yeah, so basically this guy got very famous for this TED Talk, and I was looking at it yesterday. It's got over 5 million views.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, he's a wealthy white cattle farmer from Zimbabwe, and he's also an ecologist. And he has this theory that he's got this method that he calls holistic management, which is basically like high intensity rotational livestock grazing. And he says that it can reverse the desert. Now, of course, science has never proven this, and people have, you know, studied this since then. And nobody has been able to prove his claims, because actually his claims are quite extraordinary. He said that the soil can hold so much carbon that it would actually reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the atmosphere back to pre-industrial levels. So that is a huge claim, and it sounds nice, but unfortunately it's completely untrue. And there's been studies to kind of counter his claims. There was one called Grazed and Confused, and it discovered that certain grazing management can sequester carbon, but it could only offset 20 to 60% of the emissions that would be produced by the animals. So it's actually impossible for his claims to be true. This method is not even offsetting the animals themselves. There's a limit to how much carbon grazing land can actually store, and it can never exceed the emissions from the livestock.
Mm.
Yeah, and I think that's another thing. Sequester and store aren't the same thing. So the carbon can sort of pass through the soil, but if it ends up getting emitted, like if it doesn't get stored in there for a long time, then you actually haven't offset anything. It's just briefly passed through the soil before going back into the atmosphere. And yeah, reading about this guy's theories has... It got me thinking, or it's something I've heard about recently, is called the bullshit asymmetry principle.
Mm-hmm.
And that's basically this idea that it takes a lot more effort to refute bullshit than it does to spread it in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And of course people are going to believe this guy. And of course farmers are going to believe this guy, because he's saying what they want to hear. And of course the meat and livestock industry is going to put money behind this to spread this message. It's okay, you can keep eating beef, it can reverse the desert.
Yeah, and misinformation spreads faster than like factual information on social media, because it sounds dramatic. It can sometimes fit pre-existing ideas or convenient ideas or support what people are doing. This is a bit of a random example, but I'm not sure if you've followed the whole Chaperone drama recently.
Oh, a little, yeah.
Yeah, and like about how she got angry at a kid and stuff, which it wasn't even true, but like it kind of like that narrative went so viral because people are like, oh yeah, Chaperone is like horrible to her fans, and like underlying that, oh, she's spoken out against Palestine, she's been outspoken around trans issues, and like, and so people want to go after it anyway. And
they
so
want a reason to hate her.
Exactly. So that narrative supports them, and there have been all kinds of people, including Chaperone herself, who have kind of like fact-checked this, who have kind of tried to set the record straight. And that is out there on social media, but it hasn't spread as fast as like people, yeah, basically promoting misinformation like a smear campaign. I know that's kind of a weird example, but yeah.
I bet people can think of heaps of examples of this. I'm thinking some of the stuff that happened right after October 7th, like there was definitely misinformation about, you know, beheaded babies and stuff, and that spread very fast, and it was difficult to refute because people just believed it and didn't want to unbelieve it.
Yeah, and even if you do refute it, it won't often reach as many people, so it might help a little bit, but it's like that narrative is still kind of getting promoted so much because it fits a certain narrative.
So I wasn't sure if people still talked about this Alan Savory guy, but he's in my head because somebody brought him up to me recently and then I remembered who he was. I'm like, oh yeah, that guy, do people still take him seriously? So actually just 2 years ago, he had a debate with a journalist called George Monbiot, which I hadn't heard of him before this, but I'm glad I have heard of him now because he's a vegan. He's very anti-livestock. And basically, the debate was very frustrating to watch because Alan Savory didn't really try to present any evidence for his arguments. And he just kind of says, like, oh, my theories can't be proven by the scientific method or something. Like, just, I don't know. You just have to believe me and my photos or something. Yeah, and even with not having an argument, people will still believe it because it's more comfortable for them to believe it.
Absolutely, yeah. And we were talking about this before, but it just this is one that kind of did get onto my radar, and I was many people kind of trying to debunk it in the comments. But again, of course, like as we comment it, the more that this was on the website, The Conversation, which is generally not like peer-reviewed articles, but by academics, more kind of shorter opinion pieces, or hopefully informed by facts as well. But yeah, more kind of shorter editorial type pieces by academics. And so, yeah, me and others debunking it or, giving a different narrative or whatever, like I also contributing to the article being popular on The Conversation. So this was the most read article ever on The Conversation, called "Ordering the Vegetarian Meal, There's More Animal Blood on Your Hands."
Oh, that article. I even remember the photo from it. Like,
yeah, published in 2011. And again, for last time I heard, it was still the most viewed article ever on Conversation. Mm-hmm. And very similar to the thing you've been talking about. It fits the existing narrative. It's like people are like, oh, you vegetarians or vegans, you're the ones being bad. And yeah, and so I imagine many people, as is typical, like not just around articles about animals, but generally have shared it without reading the article, like because that headline supports the narrative. And yeah, I won't go through a whole debunk, but just briefly, it talks about animals killed in wheat production, which is a really weird thing to go. Like, how does that, like, if they looked at like soy or chickpeas or lentils or something, it would make a bit more sense. But vegetarians and vegans are generally not replacing meat with wheat. Like, wheat is something that vegans and vegetarians and people who eat meat would generally eat, as well as like more like protein heavy food. So like people might have, I don't know, Wheat Bix or bread, and then they will put like tofu on their bread, or they'll put meat on, like it's not actually, it's, it doesn't really have anything to do with vegetarians. It's like a legitimate issue in terms of looking at the I guess collateral damage in terms of animals being killed in plant-based food production, but it's actually is not really a gotcha for vegetarians or vegans at all. But again, because it was framed in that way, and I did actually, just looking it up then, I did see there was a like an article refuting the claims. But again, it was called "Vegetarians Cause Environmental Damage, But Meat Eaters Aren't Off the Hook." But that is one that never did come across my radar, and definitely is not the most viewed on. So yeah, similar to what you said, like these things exist, but they often don't get that. Yeah. And I also want to push back a little bit, or not push back, but also just not just say us as vegans, like, oh, everyone eating animals is promoting misinformation and they need to stop doing it. But like, we all do this on social media as well. So I also encourage vegans, when we see something on social media, don't just be like, oh, this is pro-vegan, therefore I'm going to share it without reading the article because it supports my narrative. Also think about, like, we are promoting veganism because there is a good evidence base for it. There's like huge environmental impact that, yeah, it does, animal products do harm animals. And so there's so much factual stuff that we can glean on. We don't need to be promoting misinformation. So I think everyone really needs to be considering that. It's something I'm very conscious of. I'm not much of a social media person, but any article I share on social media, I've always at least read the article, not just promoting stuff because of the headline. Yeah,
I don't know how people aren't like embarrassed to share something without reading it.
Yeah.
But you know, what really, really annoys me about this, like, oh, crops cause a lot of animal deaths. That's true. But it annoys me so much because you know where most crops go, they're still fed to farmed animals.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
So
yeah,
if you want to reduce the amount of cropland, it's still a good idea to go vegan.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah, often like, and I see this in Alan Savory's arguments and people adjacent to him, they say like, oh, this land can't be used for cropping, so we have to use it for animal farms. That's the only two options. And I just find that is so capitalist brained, you know? Mm-hmm. Is what actually we need to do is have less land dedicated to agriculture overall, and then it could go back to being wild ecosystems. It could be rewilded, which would store a lot more carbon.
Exactly.
And be good for wild animals and their habitats.
Yeah.
And
it's like, oh, we can't make money from this way, therefore we have to make money from it in this other way. Like, yeah. They're the only two options, of course. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very frustrating. Yeah. Another point I was thinking of is that we have this mythology around animal agriculture that actually gets fed to us from when we're toddlers. So if you imagine like a toddler's book about farmed animals, or even the song like Old MacDonald or something, it's like you'll see this mythical farm that does not exist and has never existed, that's got one cow, one sheep, one chicken, maybe a cat, like, and there's no explanation of where the animals came from or where they're going. That's just what a farm is like. And it's, yeah, we're sort of taught to idealize that and have positive associations with it. And so then people, it's very hard for people to let go of that because it's essentially been propagandized to them.
Yeah, it's kind of this like wholesome image, like maybe like a family image, I guess, that like family farm kind of image. So it's like, yeah, animal agriculture is like wholesome and it's family and it's, yeah, something, yeah, positive. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But usually these farms are, and increasingly so, are actually like mega corporations that, you know, like Smithfield Foods or Tyson Foods or something, that are vertically integrated on every point along the production line. So, yeah, it's this type of animal farm is a myth. It couldn't exist.
Yeah, and even to the extent that it could or it has, or, yeah, there's this, like, little example, which is, like, 0.00001 of animal agriculture. Like, yeah, the animals are still being slaughtered once they're no longer producing the desirable products and those kind of things. They're still slaughtered for their flesh, or they're slaughtered once they're no longer producing enough dairy, et cetera. And so, like, there's still, yeah, there's still real harm being done to animals, even in, like, a small-scale family operation as well.
Yeah, and if it excludes nature and wild animals, it's obviously doing harm in that way too. One last thing I wanted to bring up, I've been meaning to talk about this on Freedom of Species for a while in all my talk about the wool industry, but actually the way that capitalism began, do you know this story at all?
Is it to do with cows being capital, or is that something
It's actually to do with sheep being capital.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
So capitalism started in England, like arguably in the 1700s. Like, it's hard to pinpoint an exact date which capitalism began. But the mechanism by that was they put a monetary value on land where it hadn't previously had one. So a lot more people were living in kind of indigenous ways before a monetary value was put on land. And the way they determined the monetary value was how many sheep can be grazed on that land, and how much wool can those sheep produce. That's how they could figure out how much the land was worth. So what I'm saying is that capitalism exists because of the wool industry. It all comes. Yeah. Wake up, sheeple. The sheep have always been awake. Oh, the sheep have always been woke. But yeah, I like, part of the reason that I'm vegan is because I'm an anti-capitalist, and animal agriculture is deeply intertwined with capitalism, that they can't exist without one another.
Yeah.
Actually, that's not entirely true. Animal agriculture has predated capitalism. But this, you know, putting a monetary value on land, like, that's very much intertwined with capitalism.
Yeah, and that they're producing products for which they don't get the benefit for, like, a bit like the working class, but different to the working class, they can never leave the place they produce and that kind of thing. Like, it's kind of a really intensified notion of exploitation.
Yeah, before that, animal agriculture was rather localized. So it would be like somebody is farming a few animals, which they and their family will be eating, maybe they and their community. But now it's like that is getting shipped off somewhere else. So all the damage of the land is local, but I guess the benefits go elsewhere. The money often goes elsewhere as well.
We better wrap up with our final song. Feel free to get in touch at We're at fozradio@proton.me. We've also got an old Gmail, and that will go through to that as well if you've still got that one. But yeah, anything you want to say about the final song, Betty? And make sure you stay tuned for rotations for some different music, different themes from presenters across the 3CR grid.
Yeah, so this song is just about water use, and or not even water use, just the way that water affects us generally. This is called Trouble in the Water by Common.
Okay, thanks for listening. Thanks for joining me today, Betty, and stay tuned for rotations.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.